So we're going to start the talk now on utility computing from Sun, and to introduce our two guest speakers, is Sam Walton, who is my contact here at Sun and who helped this whole thing happen, which I really appreciate, and we should all too.
So,
And I'm sorry. One thing I had to mention. We forgot to hand out to each person a voting ballot, and this is to vote for your favorite exhibit out there, because we're actually going to be judging them. And one of the things that we one of the categories is a People's Choice Award, and so this is where you get to vote for your favorite exhibit. So I'm going to go ahead and hand out one ballot to everybody who's in this room right now, and or actually, I take that back. I'm going to hand out one ballot to everybody. So that you can vote for your favorite. So I'll do that after Sam is done.
So when I was approached about the vintage computing event, thought it would be a great thing to have here on campus. But then I thought, well, how can I leverage this opportunity for Sun? Considering that right now, of course, we're really looking ahead. We don't look behind too often, but. Utility computing was an idea that we came up with because if you really look at where computing has come from, getting to utility computing is sort of a natural evolution. So I don't know how many of you know what utility computing is or isn't, but we're going to let these guys fill in all the blanks. They'll talk a little bit about it, and then we'll open it up for a Q&A if you're interested. We have Bob Fleischer, who is the Vice President and CTO for Network Storage for Sun. And Adam Mendoza, who is the Director of Strategic Alliances for our data services products. So they, between the two of them, will hopefully be able to tell you a little bit about it, and then we'll let you ask some questions. Okay?
Good afternoon. So I have the benefit of having over 30 years of experience in industry, so I know we didn't invent utility computing, and I made advice. Where it came from, okay? But for youngsters, obviously it seemed like a new idea. Before we get there, I just want to tell you guys, it's a funny exhibition because I came from Hungary, and I actually worked in Hungary for 6 years before I came to the U.S. And as you may remember, during the Cold War, the Eastern Bloc countries were about 10, 15 years behind the Western countries in computer technology. And so a lot of this stuff I actually worked in, and we had a pretty active program in both in cloning computers, Western computers, and also designing our own. Just a couple minutes, if you are interested to hear about this one. There was a very confused, the whole computer industry was actually confused back in the Eastern Bloc countries at the time. Russia was two major mainframe cloning activities going on. One of them was cloning the Siemens 4000 series, which was actually a clone of an IBM 360. And the other ministry in Russia was, or Soviet Union, was cloning the real IBM 360 family. And the 360 cloning effort became something called the unified computer architecture for these two countries. And what they have done is they basically decided that every country is going to do something. So, for example, Hungary got the 370-150, so it was 360 and 370 family, and East Germany got the 370, I don't know, 40 or 140, whatever it was. Number. So, every country got a different member of the computer family to clone. But what was really amusing that, as you remember, IBM used the FD coding for data representation. And the Russians created their own standard, which is an extension of the ASCII standard called the GOSP. And what happened is that because the Russians were forcing to run Russian, combined the Russian standard, none of the IBM software was running on the cloned computers. They had to rewrite every software specification. The other area which was cloning was pretty active around mini computers. Russians are calling the HD-1021X. Every year I saw one of the exhibitions at a 1021X computer there. And there was another ministry in Russia which was calling the PDP-11 family. And for some reason, I don't know, I was a junior engineer at the time, Hungary decided that instead of we had a research lab which was doing the GDP 11 modeling, but the company I worked for, we actually do it with a French company called CIR CNC, and we developed a 16-bit computer, and it was called Micro MITRA, which was a very interesting computer. And if you guys know what Prime computer is, when I came to the US a few years later, I ended up working for Prime. It turned out that the founder of Prime came from Honeywell. And the founder of this mini computer group at CII also came from Honeywell, so the original Honeywell, there was a Honeywell 16 mini computer, but the architecture concepts went in two different directions. So that was kind of easy for me to learn about the Prime architecture when I get there. So, anyway, so that's about kind of the historical perspective. And utility computing, you probably remember that in the mainframe space there were two operating systems, and I can't remember anymore the name of it, but there was two operating systems existing on IBM. One of them was a batch processing operating system, the other one was a time share. And what GE did is they took IBM mainframes with a time share operating system, and they started to sell compute cycles, or computing time to people. So people who couldn't afford to buy their own mainframe, they could rent the computer time on the time share. And I was working for a company in the early 80s, and designing chips, and there was a company came to us, the name was Daisy. Some of you may remember that Daisy was the first workstation company, but you may or may not know that the first Daisy actually was a front end to a GE timeshare, which is in the of the processing. And it was basically, instead of using an ASCII terminal, what GE was offering, you could actually do some spice or some other stuff. So the Daisy workstation. And you get billed by the amount of time that you were using on a GE timeshare. So utility computing actually came from a time where people wanted to have access to MIPS, not only for a division, for a project, but they didn't want to either pay for owning the computer, or they didn't want to pay for the data center and the operators and all the expertise necessary for a data center. So utility computing is not really a new idea. But what happened is it's faded away because after the early 80s, where Daisy and Mentor and later started on real workstations, then that came out with the PD2, the higher end of the PD2s, and then the VAX 780. Compute bar was affordable and easily accessible. So you could have the benefit of buying your own computers or workstations, or many of them, and run your own technical work. You know, I was in mid-80s, was working for a very small company, you know, we had about $50 million sales, and we ended up all buying a microvax and did some workstations, you know, and did some chip design. So that's what affordable at that point became. And obviously with PCs, it could be even more affordable. But what really happened is that people eventually, you know, once the IT guys woken up to the fact that they had 20,000 PCs and 10,000 workstations and hundreds of computers and networking and gigabytes and terabytes of storage hanging around in the organization, and they had actually no idea what they had. You know, I recently talked to some customers and they tried to do a survey about what kind of computing assets they have, never mind the utilization, and they discovered is they don't know. And not only they don't know what computers they have, they actually don't know what software is running on what. One of the funny stories I heard a couple of weeks ago that a bank decided to sell up some of the retail operation and focusing on commercial banks. So what they did is they went to the data center and they built inventory and they said, okay, this computer was running the retail, you know, retail banking, and this was commercial banking. And they basically could have seen a drop, including the applications and the base and the database, whatever, okay? And moved it to the new data center, which was built by the spin-off bank itself. They set it up, nothing went. And they spent about 6 months trying to figure out what happened. And turned out that, you know, they hired consultants are making calls into functions running on other computer. And so it was a pretty mishmash architecture, and they couldn't figure out how to separate the two operations. So they end up bringing all the computing system back into the original bank, and now the bank is running an outsourcing, you know, or service provider business. So it gets to a situation that the companies have such a huge level, such a huge uncontrolled mass of IT infrastructures, and they have really no idea what they're going to experience. possible for them to maintain or scale, and if they have to bring up new businesses, for example, new services, like you want to, you are a bank and you want to go into retail banking and you want to create a new service, new application to run retail banking, it's very difficult to integrate and plug in the making board. So what's going on is that regarding the center, IT guys are extremely concerned about the hodgepodge architectures they have. And every data center, if you go see them, they're a mess. Every one of them, there's no greenfield data centers. Every one of them is the result of many years of cooperation. The worst examples are the government data centers. I went to visit some government that's every computer made by mankind, and they have critical software running on it. They have no idea how to port it. They have no resources to port it. They have to maintain computers, which probably older than what's in the exhibitions here, some of them at least. And so what happened is that there's a desire by the customers to figure out how to simplify it. So they would like to find a way of managing the data centers better, structuring the data centers better, and that it's possible outsourcing things. And so think about outsourcing as a way of companies going back to their roots. A bank offers banking services. The bank is not in the computing business, or an investment firm is in the investment business, not the computing business. And a manufacturing operation is manufacturing cars or what have you. And they are in the business, and what happens is that the technology and the way things develop force them to become IT experts. So there are new technology coming about. The technologies are in every aspect. The operating system gets rolled out, new versions, new storage systems, new storage area network, new storage technologies, virtualization, what have you. And these guys, in order for them to evaluate the technology and to deploy, they have to become experts. It's becoming very, very expensive for them to do. And so they would like to find a way of outsourcing, and outsourcing the operation of the data center. What they would like to do is go back to the GE car share, and they buy computer cycles. And so that was an interesting trend during the dot-com era, where a lot of companies actually did that. So you had service providers, different kind of service providers. ISPs were providing website hosting or email hosting for you, but there were other ISPs who put up the food chain and they provide e-commerce. So if you run an Amazon is a good example, Amazon is providing e-commerce or even eBay e-commerce for their customers. And so what you do is that you sign up and you get a certain capacity, you pay for that one, and you are hosting your website, and they do the back end, the credit card mailing. Order fulfillment for you. And so the outsourcing is actually starting about 5-7 years ago, and it's the result of business simplification. Customers would like to simplify businesses. So the problem is when you do outsourcing, then you go into the other end of the buyer, because the people who provide services, they have to figure out how to architect their data center or the way that they can actually make it outsourceable. And that's a really challenging proposition. This is where utility computing is coming about. So to take a data center, which is in the past with a hodgepodge of things planned together through who knows what, shrink them and double them and whatever, okay? And for them to turn it into a set of resources you can partition and measure and build for, it's hard. But that's what utility computing is about. So a lot of the technologies are necessary to make it work. You need to have partitioning, for example. You need to be able to take a compute resource and break it up into smaller chunks. The reason this is important, a service provider could give every customer their own computer. But the problem is that the computers are expensive both in terms of hardware and also for maintaining the human cost. But and the utilization is tend to be very low. If you go to data centers, you find that the server utilization, even the transaction processing environment, is relatively low. And what happens, the network utilization is very low. Most of the data centers today are still 20 megabits per second. And the SAN utilization is relatively low. And so you have to separate vendors pushing 10 gigabit and the customers needing 1.1 megabit. Okay, so and the server utilization is such today that people have abundance of things. So one, you know, one in one sense you provide a dedicated computer for each of your customers if you are a service provider. But because the utilization level is so low, and for each computer, it's not only the hardware cost which is going to cost you a lot, but the labor cost for managing a particular computer. People like to take a computer for storage, you know, and then share it with many users. So this is like the timeshare idea of capabilities coming back. Okay? So how do you do that? Well, you have to partition it. So there are a number of partitions available. IBM has something called LPAR, logical partitioning. What they can do is they can take a computer and dig it up into separate logical partitions. And each of the partitions is like it's a type around the one version of the OS and applications. Okay? That's a mainframe technology and running a very expensive mainframe hardware. So we have technology called the Solaris containers. Solaris containers is kind of very similar, but it's running on the Unix environment. There are some other partitioning available. That you have a server, you call it different blades. So you don't have a separate server, but you have a separate CPU memory complex associated with the particular domain. So there are different kind of partition technologies available, and they provide different degrees of security, different degrees of fault isolation, because the fault domains are shared in every partition environment, and the fault and the level of sharing is dependent on the partition technology used. Finally, you know, you need to do something called the performance isolation. What happened is that while the server utilization tends to be low, customers tend to have bursty needs for the computer. So, you know, you may have a period of time, you know, when you sell something, you know, some customers sell something for Christmas time, other ones for Halloween or whatever. Okay? So there is bursty activity going on around the time when you know, major businesses. And you want to make sure that your computing requirements, or quality of service requirements are being met. So one of the important measurements in utility computing for SLA, service level agreement. Service level agreement, as you know, it's a contract. It's not something you actually measure. Service level agreement stipulates that I'm buying computing cycles from you. You are a service provider. And what happens is that this is the level of quality of service which can be measured I'm expecting, and this is the type of availability I'm expecting, and this is how much I pay you if you meet my SLA, and this is the penalty if you don't meet my SLA. So SLA is today governed the contractual part of the computing. Okay? And so what happens is that when you have a situation and your performance demand is very bursty, and you have a very tight SLA, that the service provider have to make sure there's a performance isolation for the particular domain. And you know the security isolation, it's another complex area. Obviously you want to make sure that people can't go in and take your customer's credit card information or something like that, you know, or mock up your order database. But if you go to you know things like government customers, obviously the security requirements are much tighter. But interesting enough, if you go to some of those bioinformatics companies, you know, they have tighter security requirements than the government has. And because, you know, what they do is more the research and their information is just much more tightly protected. So there are different degrees of security requirements are also set up by the customers, which the service providers have to manage. But if you go back into the data center, you know, you have to think about virtualization. Virtualization is, let me just go back to the partition. So you have to partition compute resources, you have to partition network resources, and storage resources also. This is where we can talk a lot about the storage and things like that. But one of the way to do that is the technology which Sun is working on for virtualization. And virtualization is, again, an old concept. But it's applied at the data center level. So those of you who remember, it was invented by University of Manchester on an Atlas computer. That was the first machine which has virtualized memory back in the 60s, mid-60s. Okay? And every computer has virtual memory implemented to the PC. And what happened is that it's the same concept which is used for virtual memory. You can extend it for storage, or you can extend it for compute resources or network resources. So when people talk about virtualized data centers, they are applying the concept of further virtualization to a higher, a broader range of systems which are implementing different kind of functions. So how do you virtualize a network? Well, that's a relatively easy thing to do because there's an IGP standard called VLAN, and this VLAN basically lets you to make an IP network and create subnetworks out of it called VLANs, each of them tag, each of them has separate security domains, and you can assign POS to them. Okay? There are similar concepts that is called other channel networks called vSAN, and vSAN lets you do something similar. And or computers, you virtualize computers by providing partitioning within a machine, but also by taking a bunch of machines and making them look like one. So simply make you look at virtualization like a layer for load balancer. A layer for load balancer, but it provides you with horizontal scaling. And so what happens if you have a web server and you are accessing the computer resources to the internet? What happens is that the web server is front-ended in a switch called a layer for virtualization switch. And when you go into eBay, you go into Yahoo, you always go to Yahoo.com, and Yahoo.com has one IP address which you get from DNS. But behind that one IP address, there are actually hundreds of servers. And this layer for switch is basically virtualizing and make all the hundreds of web servers look like a single scaling of server using a single IP address. And so one server goes away, then you haven't really lost any service. You may have increased the latency getting access to Yahoo. Or conversely, if Yahoo wants to expand the amount of performance they can deliver to customers because there's a lot of interest in the website, so they can just plug in more servers and the layer four switch virtualize them and make them look like a single IP address.
On the storage side, what happens is that virtualization is used for more similar, solving a similar set of problems. What happens is that each of the storage systems has a finite capacity. And customers could go and buy more storage systems or large storage systems. They come with different price performance ratios. And they could go to buy smaller or mid range storage system. And what happened is that if you put a virtualization layer in front of you, which is kind of similar to layer for switch, what happened is that you can carve up your storage capacity into chunks and map the chunks into different applications running on the servers itself. But the chunks actually may appear contiguous to the application. They're actually part mapped into different storage subsystems, independent storage subsystems. And so virtualization lets you to create an almost infinite capacity pool, storage pool, which you can carve up into small pieces and send to different applications. So the other part of for distributed computing is the ability to do measurements, telemetry, and billing. Okay? So what happens is that you have to find a way of measuring how much compute resources the customer is using. And it's a pretty complicated problem, but there's a lot of technologies being developed for that. So that's
sure. I don't have that kind of a historical perspective.
Everyone's making
a So I've been in the IT industry for over 17 years. Developer. Application developer, mostly in the Unix space for the most part, but Fortran on mainframes, using cards, dropping cards, getting my cards all mixed up, numbering my cards when I learned my lesson, losing my cards, on and on and on. But in any case, with respect to utility compute, let me talk to you about a couple of different perspectives and some of the things that Bala mentioned with respect to the ability for us to be able to take a number of disparate resources, a combination of, you know, all the way from the application down into the storage subsystem. It's happening today that we are able to effectively pool these resources and then be able to present them to different users according to, you know, a very, very simple and very, very well-defined security access method with authentication of the rest of it. But before, you know, I think we talked a little bit about all the different technology components, but what is utility computing? Right, is utility computing really grid computing? Is it the ability for us to pool all these resources and bring them all together? Is it really a business model? Is it something that somebody says, you know what, I'm gonna look at how you use the environment, I'm gonna determine how often your users access the environment and what resources are being used and use storage resource managers and network managers, et cetera, to look at all that utilization and then start building based upon that? Is it autonomous data centers, you know, where essentially we have an application that is has some reliability and availability requirements associated with it, and incidentally, we throw as much components, you know, for servers as well as network components as well as storage in order for that application to continually be available. And how that accomplished through some clustering technologies, some other mechanisms, you know, I mean, in the Unix environment, you know, it's about scripting and making sure to always hit the heartbeat, look for the processes that are supposed to be up and running. There's also another concept, I think, that you also mentioned with respect to virtual data centers. You know, is it the ability for us to be able to define an entire set of not only compute resources and application resources and all that, but effectively say for that particular customer, all that capability along with all the tools for managing that environment. So utility computing really comes back to today, to what customers are really looking for is, yeah, I want a really simple way of being able to use resources when I need them. And I want to pay for those resources when I need them, and I don't want to pay for them when I don't. And how do we accomplish this for a customer? Different ways, whether you put it within their environment and essentially get that metering function to be very accurate to determine how much they're using, or you outsource or you put it in some other service provider environment. Either model has the same requirements, okay, the same amount of requirements in terms of being able to take a service level requirement from the customer. Being able to guarantee it. So that comes back to what a customer then says. Okay, I want this up and available. And so first I want to be able to have my model reflect when I need it and pay for when I need it and not pay for when I don't need it. And then the other piece is when I do need it, you have to guarantee that I can have it available. So that's another really critical aspect of being able to create a utility computing model for any customer, for any environment. It's interesting that you've got places like SunGard and other disaster recovery locations and sites. I don't know if anybody here's, you know, had to work through that, but how many times do they resell that particular disaster recovery site? Many, many times. They are gambling a lot of times. And nowadays, that's not good enough. Nowadays, you have to be able to effectively say, you know, if my load and every single customer that you have that's going to be going to that data center, through those telecom lines, to get that process, it better be available. Or, you know, litigation begins. Right? So the intent here is to then say, all right, from a utility computing perspective, okay, do we include all of those pieces for just the day-to-day operations, or does it extend to disaster recovery? It does. It has to. Because the data is produced no matter what. We have an environment that essentially, at Christmas time, I have a spike in utilization. I need to use a lot more cycles or a lot more systems or a lot more storage, and therefore, all that data has to be stored away somewhere. So today's interesting regulations, Sarbanes-Oxley and SEC requirements and all the rest of that are such that, you know, even if you just have a virtualized utility environment, et cetera, that you don't use when it spikes, you have to keep all that information. So it's a much bigger problem than you might, you know, see in the newspapers or information leak or all the rest of it. It's not just the non-demand kind of capability. It has to actually have all of these other aspects of availability as well as all the way that the methods to be able to sustain government regulation requirements. So let's look at how people will be paying for. You know, what does the customer want to see? Now that they've actually said, I like your model, you know, what? Tell me what's my return on investment going in that direction. Now, what do I get out of it effectively? So right now, as far as storage is concerned, you know, you break it down to pennies per megabyte. This many pennies per megabyte per year for this number of years. And if you use it, great. If you don't use it, you don't pay those pennies. Well, when you're talking about terabytes worth of data, what's that? Over 3 years, perhaps $7 million. And that's just for storage. Okay, so utility computing, you have to look at those return on investment aspects in terms of when I do spike and when I drop, how much money am I actually spending? That's the advantages come down to I can get resources when I need them. It's you know, relative to whatever the current demand happens to be. And if I go with a good company that provides that capability, they have all these other regulations and requirements taken care of. But the disadvantage is, and one of them that Balan had mentioned is, okay, security. So if you, SunGard, have an environment that's used for disaster recovery and a disaster happens on the eastern seaboard, then how is my information protected from that other competitor's information, from the other competitor's information? So that is clearly an aspect that you have to ask these folks that say, you know, we're going to offer you up a utility computing model. Great. So how do you guarantee that I won't go to jail because that data that essentially was generated is no longer there? It's the liabilities of the company that actually has produced the data in the first place, not of the person who's storing it for it. What do they know about the information? So let's talk about, we talked a little bit about what that business aspect happens to. It's, I pay you, I just increase the amount of money that I'm paying you on a monthly basis when I need. When I don't need it, I don't pay. How about the technology associated with it? We talked a little bit about the fact that there's a variety of different types of virtualization capabilities that you have to have. This set of resources, no matter how complex, et cetera, to a user, it has to look like the same environment, the same set of resources they always use. And so that's another consideration and aspect of the utility computing model. Behind the scenes, what resources do you actually have? For availability, what redundancy do you actually have? So there's a variety of those factors, but the operations of it. Let's talk about how people actually do their job and how IT actually gets around to being able to guarantee or be able to service a requirement for the user. So the user says, or the customer says, you know, I'm going to increase my utilization I expect for Christmas holidays. I'm a retailer. Essentially, I get a real big spike, probably, I don't know, something like 20% more customers. You can expect at least that much more information and data. So how do you service that effectively? Let's get the next angle in terms of how to be able to give a customer utility computing model. And the way to do that effectively is you've got a lot of the information associated with the utilization based upon network management tools, storage management tools, tools within the application itself, Oracle has some reporting functions and capabilities. And you have to aggregate all that information.
But let me add something.
Sure.
There are two famous cases in the service provider space which told the industry about capacity management. One of them was when Victoria's Secret came out with their catalog. And that was an unbelievable meltdown, you know. And the second one was when the Clinton papers were released. And so what happened is that
it was really interesting. I read about those cases because most times, you know, they used to use the rule of thumb that you know, you expect X level of access, then you double your capacity plan for it, and then you double it again, you know, just to give a safe cycle. Okay. So there was no science behind it, but if you went into their service providers, you know, what happens is that they try to over-provision it 4X just to make sure that you are on the safe side. And these two cases were so interesting because what happened is that they were so vastly underestimated the capacity, the level of interest of the capital requirements that they could not provide the QoS, you know, which was the effective website response time in this case. I mean, you could argue that nothing happens if you can get access to the Clinton papers or the Victoria website. Okay? But that wasn't really the point. The point is you could use that example for other meltdowns also, but they were just such a famous cases that people spend a lot of time looking at analyzing traffic patterns and their system behavior, you know, how fast the system can respond or organization can respond to the demands. And most of the other cases are not as rapidly going the rates, you know, but these are pretty famous cases. I'm sorry.
No, those are perfect examples of when the customer has a request for additional resources, you know, or customers have requests for additional resources. How do you service those resources? I mean, there's a set of manual processes associated with that, but how much automation, how much autonomy is in, if you will, the virtual data center in order to be able to meet that? What is available today to be able to effectively say, we've got a spike of that nature for that particular application, and that application happens to be, I don't know, maybe priority 3. It's not priority 1, which is my highest. It's a priority 3. It's a website for whatever pictures happen to be there. But my priority 1 is my billing application or my customer services application for information for their accounts. That's where some of the capabilities like the grid containers that Balan mentioned earlier. You're given a certain set amount of resources associated with that application. And that application, if it starts growing and growing, it can dwarf and take over all of the other resources. So you have to have something that is cognizant and aware that essentially says, you know, once you've gotten up to the full capacity of what I've provided that you've requested, storage or network capacity or processing capacity, that's it. I'm cutting you off. So when you consider utility computing from that perspective and that nature, what is being provided by that particular utility computing service provider? Are they guaranteeing that kind of capability where one set of business critical applications are going to get affected by the trivial ones that are on the same platform?
So I can give you a couple more related examples. One of them is a long time ago. Thank you. I studied the telephone exchange design, you know, and what happened is that, I don't know if the statistics are still correct today, but the peak phone demand at that time was between 11 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon. And so what happened is that if you go to a telephone company, they could not really design a network and a switching architecture, which would sustain the peak demand, which was between 11 and 2 for all day, because it just wasn't economic enough. And so the philosophy they had at that time is that, you know, you just didn't get it by everyone. You know? Now, I assume that there are no capacity limits today for telephone exchanges, but let me give you guys a more contemporary example than that. The whole N1 discussion and some came about from an interaction we had with a service provider in North Carolina back in 98 or so. And I went to see those guys, and I didn't start N1, but you know, that was just a collection of data because we get. And you probably know that they were service providers, they're no longer in business, but they were service providers, and they were hosting local businesses and radio stations and TV station websites. And what happened is that the problem they have in every single service provider has is that they have to deliver services which has high value to the customers. The customers pay money for that, but they have to do that at the lowest cost basis. So the service provider is actually a very interesting business because I don't know any other business, maybe the airline business is similar, but they understand the cost basis so well. You know, they know exactly the cost of providing the business. And kind of digressing here is when we visited Rackspace a few years ago back in San Antonio, and Rackspace is one of those guys who survived this whole service provider meltdown. And I talked to them about their business model, and went into their data center, and they had this, the shiny called the Metro Rack. The Metro Rack is what people use in like restaurants, chrome wire racks and stuff. So they had Metro Racks there with their normal servers, cheap servers, hard configurations. And I asked them about it. They said, they have the operations in London and they have operations in San Antonio and other places, and they know their power, the cost of power, cost of cooling, cost of the square footage. And they figured out that it's cheaper for them to buy in San Antonio Metro Racks and traditional servers, and in London, 19-inch racks, and recommended servers because that's how optimized the business. So these guys understand, and they showed that they actually understand the operational cost of the penny. So basically, the service providers are, the profit they are making is the service they provide to their customers, to the value of their service versus the cost basis. Okay? So anyway, so this guy in North Carolina was telling us that they are hosting the local TV station, and as you know, they are in hurricane. They have a hurricane season from July to November, and so what happened is that the people go to the TV station's map to see what's happening with the weather. And when hurricanes are reported, they look at the past and they try to figure out what they should be doing. And so they have a really interesting access, because you can imagine, there's very good access between November to July, and in July it starts growing, and whenever there are hurricanes are coming, they have these huge needs. And they absolutely have to provide, satisfy the requirements and provide access to the weather mass because it's like a navigation. And they also discovered that hurricanes are coming, we can go by the refrigerators much, And so what happened is that they had almost an inverse access rate for some of the local businesses. And so they wanted to find a way of creating some knobs to the data center where they could take away resources from the refrigerator store website and add it to the weather map website. Okay? Because this way they could provide the QoS level prescribed by most customers, but the assets are lower. That's what happened. They don't have to plan for peak assets. Another example we have in New York. In New York they have this thing is called offline betting, which is a weekend activity. And it's a weekend activity, so you have to provide that access to the weekend, but not the weekdays. So if you provide that, So what happened is that if you have a data center and you have these knobs, and the knob lets you to turn down resources for businesses which don't require the power, the computing power, and turn it off and give it to the other ones, allocate them, then you can provide you can balance the resource, balance the request rate, still maintain the required quality of service levels to each of the customers, but at the much lower cost basis. And so this is why, this whole area of not only providing utility services and giving to the customer, but also optimizing the cost basis, so you don't have to design your data center. So it's like everybody's
So I guess with respect to the different angles of different areas, see it's not an easy problem to face. It takes effective business model to be able to provide something to a customer without going out of business really quickly. It takes the technology behind it to be able to essentially balance the requirements associated with different customer sets. For example, if you're providing a variety of customers. And then the operational disciplines to be able to say, okay, now how do we actually provide a bill to the customer? Somebody has to be able to meter it, measure it, and provide it for them. So utility computing makes the job of providing services, IT services, I'd say that much more harder. Because now you're having you're having to completely, if you will, hide all that complexity and provide that same quality of service no matter what is going on within the environment, within the world outside itself.
So let me tell you guys a little bit of geeky stuff. I'm a geek just like you guys are, okay? So I just got on eBay. This is the most wonderful computer I ever owned. You know, it's a Sony UX50. And I waited until the price dropped 50%, you know, because I didn't want to pay the payment for it. But and I was one of the early buyers of the new thing that came out, the first one. Okay? And I've been looking at this technology because it's a really interesting technology. It's not about being cool, but it has a Wi-Fi built into that, you know, and obviously it doesn't have GPRS built into it yet, okay? But the whole idea is that you carry basically, if you think about that, the information you operate on has a private component, you know, pictures of our dogs or cats or kids or whatever it is, okay? And then you have the information which you interact with people, emails or messaging or something like that. And then you have business information, whatever business emails, or if you are a salesman, that the cost of the stuff you are selling, okay? And so what happens is that there's three sets of information, the private, the public, and the business information, which are sitting somewhere. I basically, as a user, don't really care where the information is, I don't want to know, I don't want to deal with it, and I don't want to have any kind of concepts about why is it backed up, or how is the business, the business contributing. So I'm a user. Okay? I just want to make sure that my information is always with me, it's always available whenever the Wi-Fi is plugged in. I wish I didn't. I mean, you guys don't know that Sony is not designing this stuff anymore. Basically, it's kind of newer and stuff. But then you have PDAs which have GPRS and mobile phone access also built into that. Okay? So this is an information which this is a product which lets me to find. This is not a commercial. Lets me to find my way around because I actually have a GPS Bluetooth receiver mapping. So I can find myself. I can have access to my email. I have my personal information with me. I can access public information. Okay? So what happened is that, I'm one of the believers that this is the way the data access in the future. So you are going to see a lot of mobile phones, that's a longer discussion. I don't want to get into that, but the mobile phone is in my mind is the kind of the gateway to the type of information that we are all going to have designing in different places. So the phone company is going to be the company which is aggregating the data and making the data real time available to you. So they will have to develop push technologies and real time synchronization and stuff like that to the stuff, the devices you are carrying around. Okay? So I think the trend is going to be utility in even at vendors. What happened is that as the information is moving to this accessible anytime, anywhere, by any device, and again, a combination of the different classes of information, the only way you can do that by having this platform, which is very highly manageable, scalable, partitionable, and billable, because you get charged for the stuff.
First rule of network design is put the data as close as you can to that.
Well, closeness doesn't mean accessible. So, you guys have any questions? Any comments? Yes.
Well, you did mention as far as like time of day. You look at the phone model, and then you look at your punch card models. You put the punch cards in at night. Is there, you talk about cost and pennies or megabytes, but it seems to me like to demand response, to get the peak, it's time of day you charge for. So if you go on during peak demand, it's going to cost you a lot more than if you do
self-peak. So the problem with the time of day is that we are a global organization, So I was in the Far East, a couple months ago, and I was accessing information from Kuala Lumpur, where Sharon, was sleeping. Presumably, I don't know, but and so what happened? What you want to think about is that Sun is a global company, and a lot of companies are global companies, And so while I may be using the network access points based on peak hours, okay,
but the data is actually not, you know, my data wasn't sitting in Kuala Lumpur, it was sitting back here. And so you could argue that my data set was accessed by me off hours, okay? But the same thing happens if you have, we have design centers in Norway and France and Germany and California and Russia and whatever, okay? A bunch of different places. And we have projects which are done, you know, the follow the sun kind of model, okay? And so you could argue that there are cases where you are accessing the data kind of all the time, you know, you have a pretty flat access rate, you know, but there are other cases, you are right, you know, where you have big demands and you should be able to charge for them.
But, you know, does it also give an unfair advantage to overseas companies versus us because of that peak demand?
Right, yeah. Ultimately, I think customers are going to continue to demand flat rate processing. Right? The more I use, the more I'll pay, and that's it. Done. End of story. You know, I don't pay more on my cell phone when I'm using it peak. I may not get a signal. I get a rapid busy, but I don't pay for more when that.
You pay the same, but you get less.
You pay the same.
You pay the same, but you get less.
Yes. So, but you know, I mean, the trend is not to have that kind of a need.
It's kind of interesting, you know. I'm sorry that years ago was this trend or discussion about micropayments, and the whole idea about micropayments was that, you know, we are using internet resources, information or what have you, and the people who have the information, they will get charged for it, and the hope was that they are going to find a way of charging you by, you know, you are retrieving an article from a magazine or you are whatever it is, okay? And none of this work except downloading songs. You know, what people are doing, they prefer to have a flat rate, all you can eat kind of payments for mobile phone or for information access or Netflix, you know, or whatever it is, because you really don't want to think about managing your customers, okay? And you really want to be very conscious about using the data, of course, to what it costs you. The song download is different because it's a purchasing event. You know, so you are actually not getting the service, you are getting the intellectual property. So I think what happened is the flat charges model is probably the one which seems to be more acceptable to people. And I know that when my example, years ago, I had a rate that you get charged for everything you use. I use it much less, and now I have a flat rate, and I use it a lot. I'm sorry, you had a question.
I was just going to say, it's not really true for the cell phone, because, you know, most plans have like 3 nights a weekend, so
yeah.
Most weeks it is cheaper. If I want to use my cell phone as a modem, I can do so at 14.4 for the cost of a regular cell phone call, or I could do it at like a higher bit rate for,
sure,
you know, a higher charge. So it isn't really a flat rate.
Well, you know, this is the area where we can pay marketing, okay?
Yeah.
You could argue it's a flat rate, and what happens is because they have such a low demand in off hours, you know, they put it in the story because it's sweet. The network happens to be what they use. We, you know, that's kind of semantics, but you are right. You could make a big capacity available.
For some reason, the advantage of being able to pay less to make phone calls at a time that I'm not calling anybody doesn't really
resonate.
It doesn't resonate.
Actually, that's a good point. So many, many years ago, making phone calls to company was very expensive. I gave like $1.50 a minute. And except if I made the call between 3 in the morning and whatever, okay? And I had the same situation. I wasn't really going to stay up for
now, you know, we talk about quality of service as well. And as you use a lot more resources, you're demanding the same quality of service. Somewhere things are going to start breaking down. So who knows? Maybe there will be a graduated pricing model because they went to 3x as opposed to 2x. Or, you know, you had. You said you were going to use 2 terabytes and guarantee 4 terabytes, and you can use 6 terabytes.
Right. So it's either that model or the model that becomes the prepaid model. Like your AP use the prepaid phone cards and prepaid other
things. Well, a different business model, yeah.
Now there was a where you control it yourself.
Yeah, but prepayment for computer services is ridiculous because the price of the tomorrow is going to be cheaper than it is today. So you don't want to buy anything you don't need yet, otherwise.
Yeah, but that would be a great marketing strategy.
Oh, yeah, that's how you get a lot of money
now. But I can provide cheaper next year.
Now, I was working for. Well, let me just put it this way: that the initials were C, and then the last initial was A. But we were doing business consulting, and we actually came across a model of really. And that was, it wasn't something that we did, but it was something that was really interesting. There were some customers that were using electricity, and they would prepay for that. They would prepay for it, and anything that was left over, because there was also a demand by corporations in the area, they could actually put it up to bid by an individual. So the individual said, I'm going to get 10 kilowatt hours for this period of time, et cetera. They were able to say, okay, I've got 2 left over, and essentially the utility company became, you know, the eBay of kilowatt hours. Now that was because, you know, there was a very limited set of resources for them.
Yes,
they tried it, but it was I think it was in the Toronto area, but it was very limited resources, very specific model, all kinds of other restrictions. But that's an instance where if you find that you have a utility kind of capability, and then you turned it around and started utilizing it for a different business model altogether. So the less electricity you use, you can potentially turn it around and make money for yourself. So maybe I can sell my cell phone.
Any other questions?
Just one more, you were talking about this virtual technology, and you also talked about the ATMs, but the off-track betting. The one that I asked you about, I don't know if you know anything about the G-Tech model, the lottery thing, because here a sole source machine, it's a little machine that sits in, you know, your local grocery store or wherever, and in a worldwide network systems. And when they have a recovery or repairing their system, they just send a new box out. But I assume there must be a peak flow in that too.
I don't know that business. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But it is the same type. It is an analogy of the system I talked about.
Yeah. If you look at clustering technologies and the ability for you to take a, let's say that you don't have 2 very high-end systems that are highly redundant, et cetera, you have 10 mid-range or low-end type of processors. Now, the intent there is any one of those drop the rest of the load and the application, et cetera, has to be able to continue. That's very difficult to do, especially in a transaction-oriented environment. But if you can partition the application so that you can do that, or have logging, enough logging in there so that you can rebuild what the process was, there's a possibility to utilize that. So instead of spending the money on hardware, you're spending the money on the software to ensure the availability.
There's one final comment is that if you guys are not familiar with Sunray, you know, you may want to read about it on our website. Sounds like Sunray is maybe similar to that lottery technology. Sunray is a stateless device. You know, effectively, Sunray is like the modern day version of 32/7G terminals. Okay. And don't tell it to the summary. And so you know, the whole, just like in fashion or everything in life, things are going back in cycles. Okay. And so some believes in the centralization. You know, so what happened, compute resources are going to be centralized back in a data center. And the reason we believe in that is because it helps you to manage better the resources, partition the resources, measure them, do equivalent to computing or whatever. Okay. And what happens is that what's sitting at your desk is either Sunrays, you know, which are stateless devices, and if it breaks, you know, you ship another one, and there's no, you know, it because of bank address, but otherwise, you know, it gets personality by plugging in your Java card. You know, your Java card basically is your identity card. It's like the equivalent of the SIX card of your mobile phone. When I plug it in, that suddenly becomes my workstation. You know, when I unplug it and plug in your card, it becomes your workstation. We are working on a technology which actually connects the phone exchange, the phone extension, you know, the phone in your office to the some soft switches. So what happens when I plug in my card, not only that your workstation become your workstation, but your phone become your phone extension. Okay? So the two access models to the data would be sunray when you are not mobile, or through phones or something like that when you are mobile. You know? But fundamentally, the data is sitting in your centralized data center, and you can access it any different way, and many different ways. And it doesn't really matter how you access the data. The data is structured in a way that you can go through different kind of clients. Once it's in a data center, then you can start think about how to build giant data centers, which is partitioned into customer-specific segments, you know, and you can charge back. So this is kind of the big philosophy we have around, you know, data center architectures and networking and computing and distributed computing. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things which are working on, which enables delivery for that vision.
So the cool thing about, you know, something like this is, if I'm working, I've got 5 or 6 applications, so, okay, work problem, you know, spreadsheets, you name it, whatever. I pull out my card, I go somewhere else, anywhere in some campus, plug it back in. Those same 5 applications, everything, the whole personalization is there.
It's actually the session state that application. So you are in the middle of writing an email, you know, and it comes back. All right, thank you for coming. Really appreciate it. And if you guys are exhibitors, thank you for bringing all the good old stuff here. Just want to see them.